Welcome back here on to the Mighty 690 KGGF as we continue our conversation with K-State Research and Extension offices as we've got James Coover and Jacob Weber here in studio. Don't forget phone lines are open at 620-251-6909. You may have a handful of questions regarding maybe some noxious weeds as we continue our conversation with this as well. So really, we mentioned it. Obviously, last year in comparison, it was dry. We had to worry about that. Are things even going to grow? Are we going to get enough nutrients and water? This year, way too many things are growing at this point, whether it's bacteria, anything like that, and noxious weeds, I'm sure, are just running rampant right now. But James, what are a couple of the ones that you've seen more prominently? Obviously, Sarissa, Spadiza, just kind of list off what are the ones that you've seen the issues with.
So, I mean, some of the noxious weeds, we have Sarissa, Spadiza, we have the thistles, and there's good thistles and bad thistles, but we also have Johnson grass. And technically, even field bindweed is a noxious weed. And so there's a lot of things growing out there right now. They've had plenty of moisture. And some of these things do all right in dry weather. I mean, Sarissa grows pretty good in dry weather, but wet weather makes it really explode. And so, I mean, right now, and so with the thistles, we're kind of looking at some different areas. We've got musk thistles and Canadian thistles, and those are the bad ones. But we also have some good thistles, and so, well, not good so much as not invasive.
Just a little better.
Yeah, they're native, and so they're all right. We have plains thistles and wavy leaf thistles. And there's actually another weed called a teasel, and it looks a lot like a thistle. We're seeing it all over the ditches right now. If you're driving along, you're looking at something, it looks like a thistle. It's probably not actually. It's probably a teasel. It's actually from Europe. It's invasive, but not really noxious. It doesn't really take over pastures like thistles do.
Great. And, of course, they had to name it very, very similarly to it as well. So teasels. Okay, well, real quick, I guess, just before we kind of dive into that, the difference between good and bad thistle, is that just overly invasive, or really what's the difference between the two of those?
Yeah, and so really the difference is, I mean, the ones that aren't too bad, most of those are actually native. Okay. And really, they just don't spread like the other ones do. And cattle can sometimes somewhat graze on them, but not so much. They just kind of hang out there. You'll see a few of them, but you often don't see a whole lot of them unless you're overgrazing your pasture.
Absolutely.
And so they're just kind of out there.
So let's talk about the comparison between the two of them and really what you can do if you have quite a bit of them. Because I know, like you had said, on whatever particular highway you were saying, they were just running crazy within the ditches.
Yeah, here between, the Independence and 400, there's a whole lot of them in the ditch. And there's some others in some other places, too. Yeah. And they look like thistles, but they're actually, the structure of them is a little different. And they don't explode into that poof of white like thistles do. They'll maintain their form in a way. And the thorns on them are a little different. If you got close, if you held them side by side, you'd be able to tell pretty easily that one's different. And so, but with the thistles, that's actually, with teasel, I don't know that you really need to control it too much, but with thistles, it's kind of a different situation. And so if it is the invasive ones, it is kind of important to get out there and control them because they spread very quickly.
Absolutely.
There's both actually teasels and thistles are biennials, so they're 2-year growth. The first year they'll stay as rosettes, which is kind of flat on the ground. It just looks like some thorny little plant that's doesn't get very tall at all. And the second year is when they shoot up that stalk.
Oh, I don't gotta worry about that. Yes. I'm out of nowhere.
Yeah, you can't even see them the first year, and that's when they're much more able to be sprayed and treated with a herbicide, something that controls thistles like dicamba or pichlorum or famelates that really does a number on those kind of things.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about in terms, say you do have a bad set of them and you need to get out there. What to cut them down, burn them? I mean, what is your suggestion for control?
Yeah. And so after a certain point, once they get to the second year, when they're already starting to bloom, they're very difficult to control. Sometimes it's impossible to control. Sometimes you'll see people out there with a shovel and cutting them off below the crown level, which is really about the only for sure way to get rid of them.
Really?
So, because I mean, once they bloom, they become resistant to herbicides, like the vast majority of things. But it's actually different from Sarissa lespediza, because Sarissa, you actually want to wait till blooming to treat it. because that's actually when it's at its weakest. If you treat it too early, it'll just grow back from the root structure. And so Sarisa, we haven't even got to its treatment point yet, which happens about the end of August to beginning of September.
Gotcha. So. Well, okay. Well, let's try and see. I mean, obviously, if it's into their second year, is there easy ways to identify it when it's like flat on the ground, like you had mentioned, before they pop up? Or is it kind of, you know, obviously it's a little easy to brush by as well. But
yeah.
What would you do? Is that at its weakest point then, is when it's laying on the ground there in its first year?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. When it's laying on the ground its first year. And it's hard to tell the difference between the good thistle and the bad thistle in the first year. Yeah. But most farmers know, like they've seen them out there in the field. And so if they've seen a lot of the must thistle, Canadian thistle, there's a good chance that's what it is. And the thorns are a little different. If you held one side by side, you'd be able to tell the difference. Yeah. But I would say if you've had a history of noxious weeds in your field and you see those rosettes, just spray them. I mean, yeah. There's no real point in trying to save
Absolutely.
A few good ones. So.
Absolutely. Well, it looks like you guys either, I don't know if that's your book or packet or whichever, but I know you guys usually have great information available online for somebody to make that differentiator. Do you have that information online for you guys? Or?
Yeah. And so, I mean, we have the chemical weed control guide. Every year we put out a brand new publication, and at the very back of that publication, they actually talk about noxious weeds and the different chemicals they can use to control it. This is actually because it's a noxious weed, part of the State Department as well. And so on the State Department, the KDA, there's actually a noxious weed area where it goes through all the noxious weeds considered in Kansas and different control methods for that as well.
Absolutely. Well, again, phone lines are open on it as well. If you have any questions for James or Jacob, it's 620-251-6909. Any final notes or things that you really wanted to hit on about that? Real quick, I guess one last time, we'll just say the date and times about that noxious weed course that you got coming up.
Yeah, and so we're going to talk all about killing noxious weeds at this thing and different sprayers and all the aspects to that. And it'll be on August the 8th. From 5:30 to 9:00 at the Southeast Area Research Center, and that's on Ness Road. It's the intersection of Ness Road and 400 there in Parsons.
Great. All right. So again, speaking with James Coover as well as Jacob Weber here on this Wednesday morning, as we do so many Wednesdays with the K-State Research and Extension offices. Jacob, yep. I know we were talking a little bit creepy crawlers. I know you a lot of millipedes around. Anything else really in the last couple of weeks or so that people have been calling you about?
Of course, we got fall webworms showing up now. The web nests on the ends of the branches, especially on pecan trees, sweet gum. What else? Hickory, even crabapple, but more than likely on black walnut and pecan, you'll see them, and they're going to be a little a few of them that are going to show up at this point in time. Fall webworm has typically in our area two generations, so we're getting the first generation right now. And they're actually two different kind of races of fall webworm. So one of them is a little earlier than the other. But the second generation is going to show up in maybe late August, early September. And I would expect to see a lot of them this year, or the population increasing. Some years where they're so numerous that they'll, I have seen trees completely enveloped in these web nests.
Oh, wow.
To a point where the trees are completely defoliated. A fall webworm is a leaf eater. It doesn't eat anything other than leaf tissue. And it's one of those things where I say it's more of a cosmetic insect, unless, of course, you're growing pecans commercially, or you're growing pecans for your own home production, then in that case you probably want to control them. One of the better methods of controlling is, of course, just spray a residual insecticide, high pressure, right into the nest and right to the foliage right around the nest. What the worms do is they encase enclose the food that they're feeding on inside the webs. And then they'll feed on that. It's for protection. The web's not really sticky, but they do adhere to the plant fairly well. An easy way to control fall webworm on a small tree, as if with a stick, and maybe a nail, a hammer or a hit, injected into the stick at the top end, crosswise, so you can use it as a hook, and just break up the nest. Break it up and shake the worms out, and that's the end of the fall webworm nest. Some people get a little bit excited and cut off every branch that has a web nest on it, and actually they're doing more harm to the tree than the worms do. The trees are not going to die from fall webworms, but certainly a weak tree may be severely injured. A tree that's under a lot of stress for other reasons may actually die from a heavy infestation. But in that case, it's just the worms are probably finishing it off instead of killing it.
Well, in comparison from year to year, how, I mean, were they, do you, I mean, from last year, were they pretty bad as well? And I know it's kind of a prediction to where you say that second generation is going to come back.
Didn't really see hardly any last year. Hmm. Fall webworm goes through cycles, and I've seen a number of cycles over the years, and they'll become quite numerous, excessively numerous for a short period of time, maybe a year or two, and then they'll be gone. They'll disappear. Hmm. And that's because there's a predator prey environment here where there's parasites that are insects that parasitize the egg nests. The eggs are laid in the tree on the underside of the leaves. And for folks, I think putting that sticky stuff around the trunk of the tree is going to stop any insect from getting up in the tree. You're wasting your time. Insects are capable of flying, and they don't fly to the base of the tree and decide, okay, now I'm going to crawl up the tree, and they just bypass it.
Exactly.
They skip
that middleman.
There are very few insects that actually would climb a tree, and so very few situations where the sticky substance on the trunk of the tree does any actual good for controlling any pest at all. I guess the sticky stuff is probably good for getting into children's clothing and the hair and things like that. So anyway, the eggs are laid on the underside of the leaves. The eggs hatch into worms. There's probably about 250 to 300 eggs in each little nest that's about the size of a quarter. And those worms are gregarious. They feed together. So every little egg nest is going to produce a nest of worms. And they're going to protect themselves with inside those web nests. And so in years where they become quite numerous, and they're fine. There are going to be a lot of them. And there are going to be a lot of folks calling the extension office and know how to get rid of them. Well, how can I save my tree? Well, it's a kind of a gee whiz thing. You just put your hands in your pocket and say, gee whiz, and don't get too excited about it because they're ugly. If you want to get rid of the web nest, just get a stick and break them apart where you can. It's not going to hurt the tree much at all to let them out there feed on the foliage. In years where the first generation is quite numerous, the trees sometimes will become defoliated, and they typically leaf out, put out a second flush of leaves midsummer. That does take a lot of energy out of the tree to do that, but the tree quickly recovers the lost energy. But in pecan production, commercial pecan production, that does affect crop production and nut production and nut quality. And pecan producers are right on top of that. They're going to be out spraying the trees, controlling these insects right early on before they actually do any type of serious defoliation of the trees.
Absolutely. Well, it kind of sounds like, with almost a life lesson, when you initially see the issue, don't take over and go out there, and you'll probably do more damage to the tree by cutting off major branches or areas of foliage. So again, just go out and knock off the nests. I like the little rigged idea you had. Like, stick with the nail in the end of it. Yep. So pretty good idea. Again, that's Jacob Weber alongside James Coover this morning with the K-State Research and Extension offices. James, Jacob, thank you guys so much, and we'll just check in with K-State next week.
Okay, yep.
thank you.
Says the Mighty 690 KGGF.